It was a very great pleasure that our speaker accepted our invitation to come over to the UK to do a couple of presentations looking at a range of these sort of issues. Cynthia McKinney is a brave and amazing US politician. She's a former congresswoman who served in the US House of Representatives from between 1993 to 2003 and also 2005 to 2007. And during that time, she continued to campaign for the poor and underprivileged, both in her own state of Georgia and also in places like New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. But it's probably for her anti-war work, her anti-war stance, that she is best known in this country. She has consistently opposed the wars in the Middle East. As well as the first Gulf War, she has been calling for the withdrawal of troops once democracy has been established in the second Iraq War. She's also campaigning against the continued use of depleted uranium weapons, which are killing and infecting not only those people in the Middle East, but also the US troops who go home after they've served their duty in that war. And also, as well, she has tried to pass legislation restricting the export of arms to unstable or undemocratic regimes. So you can imagine, not many of these moves have made her particularly popular in the US administration. She's also questioned, and she's one of the very few high-profile politicians to have done so, she has also questioned the events of 9/11 itself. She signed, along with the victims, families and the survivors, a petition asking for a new and independent inquiry to get to the truth. And this is something that the survivors and the first responders feel very passionately about. They don't feel they've been told the whole story yet. And she's also, and this, I just love this bit, she also issued articles of impeachment against George W. Bush, Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice. So thank you very much for all that, Cynthia. It's a very, very great pleasure that Helen and I will ask you to come and talk to us. Thank you.
Well, that was an absolutely wonderful introduction. Thank you very much. Probably one of the highlights of my career will be the talk, the exchange that we are able to have this evening. I can't imagine. I can't believe I'm in, like, London. Can't believe it. So y'all don't give me too much grief about my Southern accent. The theme for tonight is confronting empire. And there are some of us who have become quite accustomed to this notion of speaking truth to power and confronting empire. But while it's a certain specific set of behaviors, it's not just words. Confronting empire also carries a personal cost. And so what I'd like to talk a little bit about are the personal costs that have been borne by others who have come before us, who dare to confront empire. And then a few of the ways in which I myself can be counted among those who have dared to confront empire. So I would like for us to begin with Memphis, Tennessee. The night is April 3rd, 1968. Think about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. By that night, Dr. King knew that he was going to be killed. After all, black FBI agents had told him years earlier that the United States government wanted him dead. But Dr. King didn't need those agents to tell him that in order to know the truth. In December 1964, the number two man at the FBI faced, quote, the difficult problem of taking steps to remove King from the national picture, unquote. Those aren't my words. Those are the words of the FBI. And so it was decided that a letter would be sent to Dr. King recommending that he commit suicide. That letter, too, was penned by the FBI. On May 11, 1965, the CIA determined that, quote, somehow or other, Dr. King must be removed from the leadership of the Negro movement, and his removal must come from within, not from without. And that, quote, somewhere at the top, there must be a Negro leader who is clean, who could step into the vacuum and chaos if Martin Luther King were either exposed or assassinated, close quote. Those are not my words. Those are the words of the CIA. By August 1967, the FBI had opened offices all over America in order to, quote, expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, or otherwise neutralize the activities of black nationalist organizations, close quote. Those are not my words. Those are the words of the FBI. Then in 1968, February, the FBI expanded its COINTELPRO program from 23 to 41 field divisions so as to cover the majority of black activity in the United States. The next month in March, March 4th, to be exact, 1968, Dr. King is specifically named in one of the FBI COINTELPRO documents as one of the program's prime targets. And of course, it was at this time, March and April of 1968, that Operation Lantern Spike was in full swing. That meant that 240 military personnel were dedicated to the surveillance of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In fact, U.S. Army documents tell us that 16,900 man-hours were dedicated to Operation Lantern Spike and the surveillance of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Then on that fateful day, April 4th, we now know that the Memphis fire chief led two individuals who identified themselves as Army intelligence onto the roof of the firehouse directly across the alley from the Lorraine Hotel balcony where Dr. King was shot. From the December 1999 trial, we know that they set up photographic surveillance there on the afternoon of April 4th. Specific unit members of the 112th Military Intelligence Group, headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, admitted to a reporter for the Memphis Commercial Record that they were there in Memphis on April 4th and not in Atlanta. So right up to the very day that Dr. King was murdered, he had 240 military personnel checking out his every move. Dr. King, America's lantern, was spiked on April 4th, 1968. From subsequent documents, we know that COINTELPRO didn't end with Dr. King, nor did it begin with him. As early as Marcus Garvey in 1919, the United States government pinned its sights against blacks who could unite and electrify that country. We know from the U.S. government's own documents that the Black Panthers, the American Indian Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the radical white left, all were targeted. In addition, from later documents, we know that the purposes and aims of COINTELPRO of the 1960s was extended to the 1970s, 80s, and beyond. From Zbigniew Brzezinski to Henry Kissinger, America's black problem was addressed at the highest levels. And anyone who sought to help America live up to its professed values got targeted along with those troublesome blacks. So on April 3rd, 1968, when Dr. King spoke at the Memphis Masonic Temple and contemplated the course of human history, from the pyramids to Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates, from the Roman Empire to the Renaissance, from the Reformation to the Emancipation Proclamation, from Franklin Delano Roosevelt rescuing a depressed nation to men rising up in Johannesburg, Nairobi, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, all saying, we want to be free. Dr. King said, that he was glad to have lived in the last few years of the second half of the 20th century to be a witness to men all over the globe rising up in a human rights revolution. He said, if something isn't done about the impoverished conditions of the world's people of color, that this world is doomed. And so Dr. King thanked God that he had lived in this very special moment in the 20th century to see the rebellion that was unfolding. Eventually that night, Dr. King came to his now famous words, "Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind, like anybody. I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. And I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." Dr. King spoke those words on the night of April 3rd, 1968. And the next day, he was dead. John F. Kennedy before him and Bobby Kennedy after him. What we now know is that Bobby had also been targeted by the FBI because it was felt that he was under Peking influence, and that Peking influence included black influence. The reasoning went something like this. Harry Belafonte was under Peking influence, and Harry Belafonte was too close to Bobby Kennedy. So it was possible that Bobby Kennedy was under Peking influence too. I have the documents that reveal this line of thinking by our own government. Additionally, before I left office, I was informed that Bobby Kennedy was considering naming Dr. King as his running mate. Just imagine the America we could have had, had that been the case. But instead, on June 5th, 1968, barely 2 months after the murder of Martin, Bobby lay slain in a California hotel ballroom. That was the end of Camelot, and that was the end of America. Today, we have a different kind of America and a different kind of leader. Even the candidates aspiring to the White House are a much different breed from Bobby Kennedy. Starting with George Bush and Dick Cheney rounding the crop up with the PNAC guys, Project for New American Century. You could say that it's become downright evil. Our president lies and sends our boys and girls off to die in Iraq. Dick Cheney can't stop taking Halliburton's money, and Halliburton can't stop taking ours. And then there are the PNAC boys who are just downright frightful. On page 60 of the Project for New American Century report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, they say, quote, "Advanced forms of biological warfare that can target specific genotypes may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool." Now, as an African American, I know that to mean MK Ultra and Paul Robeson. Hundreds of black men for 40 years in the Tuskegee study. The black bomb experiments of apartheid South Africa when they were trying to find a biological agent to put in the water that would kill only black people. You and I in this room, we care about healthcare, education, children, employment, homelessness, transportation, veterans, affirmative action, urban sprawl, air quality, race relations, drug abuse, poverty, incarceration, social justice, death penalty, political prisoners, U.S. standing in the world, war, peace. A new breed of leader has invaded Washington, D.C., and they don't give a darn about the things we care about. Instead, they believe the world is dangerous, that in this, the American century, the world is caught up in an endless struggle for survival, that there is no place for luxuries like compassion. To close one's eyes even for a second can be deadly. For one to survive, others must perish. It is against this backdrop that I say to you what you already know, that the very core of what we stand for in the world and what we know to be America is at risk. John F. Kennedy, just months before his murder, asked, "What kind of peace do I mean? And what kind of peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. I'm talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on Earth worth living. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time." Bobby just happened to be with Black America at the time of the national announcement of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. At that moment, unscripted and unrehearsed, Bobby said, "I have bad news for you, for all of our fellow citizens, and for people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and killed tonight. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice for his fellow human beings, and he died because of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it is perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are Black, considering the evidence that there evidently is, that there were white people who were responsible. You can be filled with bitterness, with hatred, and with a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in great polarization, Black people amongst Black, white people amongst white, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand with compassion and love. For those of you who are Black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and distrust at the injustice of such an act against all white people, I can only say that I feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence or lawlessness, but love and wisdom and compassion toward one another and the feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they are white or they be Black." He concluded by saying, "Let us dedicate ourselves to what the Greeks wrote so many years ago, to tame the savageness of man and make gentle the life of this world." John, Martin, and Bobby confronted empire with dignity and grace, and they died the way they lived. I can think of no better trio of men to tell us exactly what that really means. Thank you. I think now we can entertain some questions from all of you. And there's a floating mic that will come to you. So Andrew, why don't you stand up? So, okay, here's one. Anybody else have a question? two, who else? Three, four, five. Y'all remember your number, okay?
As a person born in America, I was 14 when the civil rights movement was reaching its peak, and in the United States. And I know that Britain has a very different history, and many people here may not know and be able to verify the evidence that you've given. And I think for those who might query what you said, it would be helpful if you were to quote the sources of the CIA and the FBI documents that you've mentioned, so that anyone here who is unsure of the validity of what you said can confirm it for themselves, because I've researched this stuff and I know it's true, and it's really shocking. And many people in Britain never believe me when I say this stuff happened.
Thank you very much. Yes, COINTELPRO is available. The COINTELPRO papers, which are the actual US government documents, were first revealed to the people of our country in the mid-1970s by Senator Frank Church. He called those activities illegal and un-American. And because of the events of September 11th and successive pieces of legislation that were passed in the aftermath of September 11th, many of the items that were characterized at that time as illegal and un-American, unfortunately, are now legal. But one for verification can go to any search engine on the internet. You can put in COINTELPRO, COINTELPRO, and you will find those documents there on the internet. They are original US government documents. There is a book that has been compiled by a professor who is under a bit of duress right now, Ward Churchill. And the title of his book is The COINTELPRO Papers. And so if you want physical possession, because you can print off the documents as well from the internet, but if you want a complete compilation of those documents along with a narrative that explains what they are, then you can get the book, The COINTELPRO Papers by Ward Churchill. The CIA document dated May 11th, 1965, in my estimation, is a regime change on black America, verifying that black people in the United States have been subjected to regime change. That is the search for the clean Negro phenomenon, probably perhaps first presented to us in modern day as Clarence Thomas as a replacement for Thurgood Marshall on the United States Supreme Court. But we can see now this phenomenon of clean Negroes, for example, Condoleezza Rice, who was included in my articles of impeachment. I would also like to acknowledge the presence of Jeff Blankfort, a journalist, an investigative journalist. Stand up, Jeff. An investigative journalist from San Francisco who was also active. During the time of the Great Dissent in the United States with the Black Panther Party, and who knows also a lot of background of which I speak.
Hello, Gary Hayes.
Hi.
It's on? Oh, good. Yeah, I'm a scientist. And yes. Recently of Imperial College and several other universities in the UK. Also of the Royal Air Force, where I first went in to protest against abuses. So I only worked on one particular kind of aircraft, civil aircraft. To get to the point, John Stuart Mill... Okay. I'll give you my email address later.
Okay.
John Stuart Mill, in his book... Utilitarianism said, to control the crowd, shoot 10 innocent people. And that's always been the way with governments. It's nothing new, it's nothing different. We've had this for thousands of years. And so why people are surprised now, I don't know. But I do know that people should be standing up like you and saying how it is and doing something about it.
Well, thank you very much. And you know, it's not supposed to happen in our governments. And I think that's why people continue to have this aura of disbelief, but the facts really speak for themselves. And so if one can learn how to research and then learn how to read, we have to reteach ourselves how to read. And it's not just reading black and white, it's reading our environment. And what I used to say to my staff was that we have to learn how to see the invisible, hear the unspoken, and read the unwritten. And when we know how to do that, then we can understand the environment in which we're operating. Once we understand our environment, you're absolutely right, that there is nothing that is beyond the pale. Number three. You guys don't have to applaud like every time.
Hi, Christian from the podcast documentally.com. You were the only person in Congress to hold hearings that questioned the official cover story of the 9/11 attacks. Is it true that Denis Kucinich is planning to reopen the 9/11 inquiries soon?
I think Denis Kucinich has to speak for himself. And so I can tell you what I did. And basically, with respect to the facts around September 11th, I held probably the first, the only open congressional briefing that included former CIA whistleblowers, former FBI whistleblowers, family members, academicians, legal scholars, experts of various sort to discuss their experiences, their research on what we now know as various aspects of September 11th, from the unanswered questions of the family members themselves to the finance track or the finance trail, the money trail. Various issues were explored. We had, for example, Peter Dale Scott there, David Ray Griffin, Nafis Ahmed, who lives here in London. And of course, we had Ray McGovern. We had the Jersey Girls. We had everyone who has a reputation of seriousness about the unanswered questions of September 11th. They were there, they participated. Four?
Well, I'm number five, but okay. I think we dropped one somewhere along the way. Sorry, number five here.
Were you number four? Oh, okay.
Let's
go again.
Cynthia, of course, Donald Rumsfeld famously announced on September the 10th, 2001, that he was unable to account, or his comptroller, Rabbi Dov Zakheim, was unable to account for $2.3 trillion. Because one of the most amazing pieces of footage that I've seen of Donald Rumsfeld squirming is you asking him to explain that missing $2.3 trillion. And he said he would have to get back to you. Did he actually get back to you and give you an explanation as to what happened?
Yeah, that was a day. That was a real good day, you know. You have good days, you have bad days. That was a good day. It's so much fun. I mean, it's just like, you know, people like me, first of all, are not supposed to slip through the process and get elected. We're certainly not supposed to stay on Capitol Hill for 12 years, retaining the confidence of the people despite all of the smears and everything else. But incredibly. Basically, the Pentagon, well, the United States government can't balance its books. It's not because they ship, for example, 40 tons or 400 tons, whatever the number is, of cold cash into places like Iraq and then, you know, lose track of it. It's not just that. It's because the Pentagon basically can't balance its books. And so the Pentagon says, okay, we've got $2.3 trillion in transactions that we can't track. Now, that doesn't mean that the money was lost. It just means, quite frankly, that somebody got some contracts, and they don't want us to know who got the contracts. So I asked the question about that. And then the excuse that they give for not being able to track the 2.3 is because their computers, Pentagon computers, don't talk to each other. Now, you know, this is getting to be really, really as outrageous as what, well, I won't say as what the 911 commissioners want us to believe, but what I will say is that this is becoming quite a tale. So I asked then the comptroller, how much money have you spent trying to make the computers talk to each other? And who in here is an IT, would call themselves an IT expert? Is there anybody in here who's an IT? Yeah, you're a part of the Geek Squad. Anybody else? Okay, we got a couple of folks in here. Let me tell you how much the Pentagon has spent for the one sole objective of making the computers talk to each other. $20 billion. And they said that with a straight face. So then I asked, well, who got the contract? Oh, well, you know, we don't carry that around in our head. So, you know, like, you know, the bottom line is, who gets these contracts? Well, now we kind of, I should read off of just a little bit, a few of the things that I did to confront Empire. Okay. These are not necessarily in order, but I investigated the Florida 2000 presidential election. And so I can say with quite amount of certainty that the election was stolen. George Bush is an illegal resident in the White House, but he's in the White House nonetheless. So, you know, governments have to deal with it. And of course, the $2.3 trillion, but it's, you know, things like George W. Bush putting in a defense budget the hundreds of millions of dollars, for example, for the Crusader missile, which the Pentagon didn't even want. But the Crusader missile was manufactured by a company that is owned by the Carlyle Group. Well, George Herbert Walker Bush needs a paycheck at the end of the day, doesn't he? So as long as he can get some Pentagon money, that's all good for all of us. Now, you know, the other thing I introduced was an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill to say that the Pentagon ought not buy Tamiflu pills. Well, why shouldn't the Pentagon buy Tamiflu? Because at the time, Donald Rumsfeld owned stock in the company that was selling the Tamiflu to the Pentagon. Those are the kinds of sweetheart deals that were going on, and I questioned them. The whole issue around depleted uranium, I introduced legislation to put a complete moratorium on the use of any weapon that utilizes depleted uranium. The arms trade code of conduct was watered down, but basically it became law, but it was so watered down, even I didn't, you know, it was like, it's just, we're going to talk about it. But basically, the United States ought not transfer conventional weapons to regimes that don't respect human rights and that aren't democratically elected. With respect to the Africa policy, we challenged the Clinton administration. Clinton is supposed to be, you know, the first black, honorary black president. But he forgot a few things, and one of them was responsibility for protecting human rights on the African continent. And of course, I've got my friend who is here from Democratic Republic of Congo. Yes, and we did an awful lot of work around protecting the territorial integrity of Democratic Republic of Congo from occupation from US proxies and allies, Uganda and Rwanda. Of course, there had to be truth about the Rwanda. Well, thank you very much. Well, that was just a little bit of what I did. I'll finish the list a little bit later. Okay, let's go through the next five. Okay.
Hello. Thank you for being here today. You mentioned the death of America in 68, but when did journalism die? Because to me, the major reason why people in this room are frustrated is because we know stuff that should be out there, it's not investigated. I mean, the Florida election is a classic example. If you bear in mind that what's going on now is makes Watergate look pathetic, and yet it's not really being held to account, what can we do as a, I wouldn't say a movement or whatever. One thing I have noticed is that conservatives, right-wingers, tend to be much better organized. They tend to be much better funded. If you look at post-Barry Goldwater, there was organization in the conservative movement that sort of came to fruition in the 80s and then again with Karl Rove, etc. What would your message be to people? I mean, moveon.org is a good idea, but again, it gets marginalized by the right-wing press. So, you know, Al Gore set up a TV station, but it was sort of kids doing videos. It's not news, so to speak, or serious news to compete with the Foxes and the CNNs. So what would you say to that?
I think we have the beginnings of a movement now, and fortunately, I see that it's not just in the United States, it's not just in Europe, it's not just in the UK. Now, I think we really can have a community of informed, enlightened citizens who care so much that they are willing to, quote, confront empire. And confronting empire has some personal risks associated with it. Let us be clear. I wouldn't be serving, I would not have had the opportunity to serve in the United States Congress if there weren't some black people who were willing to die for the right to vote. And there were black people and there were white people who literally shed their blood so that one day America could reach a higher level. And all of that now is being thrown away by our failure, our reticence, really, to participate in this movement. So now I see the power of one person, one mother who lost her son in Iraq. That mother is Cindy Sheehan. And Cindy just decided to do something real simple. If George Bush won't meet with me and tell me why my son is dead, then I will wait for him as he vacations in Texas. And a whole movement now of confronting people in power has developed literally because of Cindy Sheehan's audacity. And oh, who wrote that book, The Audacity of Hope? Let me not get anywhere close to that. But we have to have audacity, and we have to be willing to take risk. There are some young people in the United States, and they are also here. We are change.org, and we are change.org.uk. And they take it directly to the folks. We have to be willing to do that. First of all, I think we need to stick to the truth. We don't need to spin a whole lot of yarns. Because what these folks have done is so bad that all we need to do is realize what the truth is and speak truth. Become known as those who are not afraid to speak truth to power. We need to stick to the facts. The facts are enough to pull people on our side. And then finally, because of the lessons of COINTELPRO, where innocent people not only were murdered, as many were, dozens of Black Panther Party members were murdered, but some people actually spent time in prison for crimes that they didn't commit. You probably all know about Mumia. You may not know about the San Francisco Eight, who are former Black Panther Party members, who were tracked down by their torturers. 30 years ago, they were tortured. They made confessions based on the torture, which is not permissible in US law. And so therefore, they were set free. And now the men who happened to have been in Louisiana found them in California and tracked them down, and now they're being brought to trial for alleged crimes that were committed over 30 years ago. That's the case of the San Francisco Eight. And we have Geronimo Gijaga, who at the time was known as Geronimo Pratt. He spent 27 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And how did that happen? They spiked his legal team. How is it that James Earl Ray ends up in prison? They spiked the legal team. So COINTELPRO also informs us that you got to keep the money straight. And that's why it's so important that grassroots organizations and grassroots movements actually be financed by the grassroots. Yes, of course. I mean, you guys got me here. And, I couldn't. McDonald's? Yes. Okay, I didn't hear that. So let's go to the people who have their hands raised. One, two, three.
Thanks very much. My voice is a bit ropey because I was at Speaker's Corner yesterday, doing what we've all got to do. I'd just like to hear your comments about the Iran-Contra affair in the 80s. Many of the principals involved in that, the Elliot Abrahams, John Bolton, Negroponte, list of criminals. They were involved in shipping cocaine into the United States to blast the black community in the ghettos at the same time as funding a terrorist organization to carry out a brutal terrorist campaign against the elected democratic government of Nicaragua. These guys should, after Kerry's committee had investigated all of this stuff, they should have gone to prison for 30 years minimum, all of them. Not only did they not go to prison, they're back in power. And that explains an awful lot to my mind.
You're absolutely right. The only thing I would say in addition to that is that there's hardly, first of all, there was no such thing as crack cocaine until the United States government got involved in cocaine trafficking. Crack cocaine was cooked by a fella by the name of Ricky Freeway Wilson, who wanted to figure out a way to make cocaine more affordable to the masses. So he came up with this cooking recipe that became known as crack cocaine. There is not, I would venture to say, a single family, black family, in the United States that has not been touched in some way by the scourge of what the United States government did to its own people, and that's through the crack cocaine trafficking. Two?
Cynthia, it's a pleasure to be in your company. I'm from Iraq. You've touched on many, many, many aspects and many subjects. We least forget that the United States has been involved in 54 regime changes since 1954, since the overthrow of the nationalist government in Iran, and the story continues and will go on, continues. We are approaching 9/11. My recollection of 9/11 is Allende and Chile. Four and a half thousand people were needlessly murdered by the Americans at the behest of the Americans as a regime change for a democratically elected government. We have forgotten what happened when what America did in Angola and Mozambique. For years and years, they destroyed that country. And my friend there from the Congo, I have the pleasure of meeting him on one or two occasions. He is steadfastly, has single-handedly, have tried to bring the issue of the minerals which have been stolen, which is the cause of the trouble in the Congo. And it is ironic that all the nationalist African leaders were systematically eliminated, murdered, tortured, at all of them for no apparent reason, just purely because being black and being socially conscious. You have touched on the aspects of the struggle of the American, black American in America. But for the fact that America imports cocaine, there'll be no cocaine in Colombia. The Colombians will be able to live in peaceful life. They are being targeted, and I urge you please to take up the issue of the Colombians, because they are being tortured and killed. They are the single biggest recipient of aid after Israel, the terrorist state of Israel. I also urge you please to highlight the issue of Iraq. Iraq, you mentioned the money which was sent to Iraq and it was supposed to have disappeared. This is money which was frozen in 1991. There's all the assets of the Iraqi government which were frozen. So the money they have dispensed like confetti was Iraqi money. In the same way as this disgraceful country, Labour government in this country, have frozen the assets of Iraq in this country as well, and there's no one has been able to ascertain how much money was taken, stolen from the Iraqi people, leaving them destitute. As to the notion that they're going there to liberate the country, I wouldn't take too much of your time. They have not liberated. We have been sent back 100 years, thanks to the British and to the Americans, to the Americans firstly, and the British as the poodles to the Americans. I thank you again.
Thank you very much. We mentioned Rwanda, kind of, but everything you think you know about the Rwanda genocide is not true. I just tell you that right straight up. That was also regime change by the United States, and if a million Africans die, well, it doesn't really matter. It's not important, right? I worked very hard to get the Revolutionary United Front listed as a terrorist organization. We're against terrorism, right? So this was before the war on terrorism. An organization is chopping off the hands of little boys and raping little girls, that's terror, right? And trying to unseat a democratically elected government in Sierra Leone, they just happen to have diamonds. Well, I just want to give you this story because it's very important. Governments make decisions as state actors. There's all these different levels of analysis, and you can analyze state behavior, but then the state is comprised of individuals, and so you have to get down to naming the names of people. So I'm working so hard with the Clinton administration trying to get this RUF labeled a terrorist organization. It never happens, and then all of a sudden I believe some things were happened over here, and some of y'all say, well, you know, it may not have been legal, but I think it was something like Sandline goes in and ransacks Fode Sanko's home. Fode Sanko was the leader of the Revolutionary United Front. And lo and behold, there's a little letter there from Maurice Templesman saying, we can do business together. Well, now, maybe that's how come I couldn't get Revolutionary United Front labeled as a terrorist organization, because, you know, Maurice Templesman is Maurice Templesman. I mean, you know, he is, like, very, very, very wealthy. He is Mr. Africa. He's in charge of U.S. corporate entree onto the continent, Maurice Templesman. But he was doing business, aiding and abetting somebody whose organization was chopping off the hands of little boys and raping little girls. And because of the power of the backroom deal, the plight of the people really didn't matter. That's what we have to stop. And the only way we can stop that is by knowing who's calling the shots. And then you've got organizations like We Are Change that go and confront those people and tell the world what they're doing. And then you can go to their website and you can see what they're doing as they confront these people. You mentioned Plan Colombia. I've been working, I also was the first member of Congress to invite Afro-Latinos from all over Latin America to come to Capitol Hill and learn how business is done in Washington, D.C. Now, honestly, I tell you, be honest with you, I didn't know there were so many black people in Latin America. I didn't know it. And so now I've forged a very close relationship with the Afro-Colombians, having just been there in February for a conference. Now, the important thing is that Plan Colombia, as the gentleman pointed out, is a military program where, you know, we give billions of dollars to the government of Colombia so they can continue to spray people, displace people. And I won't say what other things they might be doing. And so I just decided that I would introduce an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill that would take all of the money away from Plan Colombia and give it to the black organizations that are doing the hard, heavy lifting of trying to protect people who are completely, absolutely defenseless. With respect to September 11th, 1973, I am involved right now with several tribunals. I'm involved with the Hurricane Katrina International Tribunal, which seeks to hold the United States government accountable for what it did not do and is still not doing on behalf of Katrina survivors. But I'm also involved in the Brussels Tribunal for Iraq, but I'm also involved in the Malaysia Peace Initiative as well. And basically, they all have the same goal and objective, and that is to utilize international courts to hold guilty parties accountable. And, I didn't even mention it, but for our young man from Democratic Republic of Congo, you might also be interested that I'm involved in international litigation that's now ongoing in Spain. To hold corporations and individuals associated with violations of human rights accountable as well. Next, is it you?
Hi, Cynthia. Hi. Great to see you again. Yeah, I was interested what you said about genome-specific weapons, and
yeah,
I wonder if there's, any connection with this DNA database that the British government is certainly obsessed with now.
I don't exactly know what the motivations of the UK government might be. However, I would fight like the Dickens if somebody wanted to take a cotton swab and put it in my mouth. I don't know what, you know, you guys, maybe, you know, that's all right with you. But I can tell you that the Pentagon has enough free space on its computers to hold personal data on for every human being on the planet. And so now, you know, through information sharing, what y'all call what, special relationship? And now with the privatization that's going on in the United States, a company like ChoicePoint could end up with your DNA information. Now, of course, when PNAC writes something like that, and as I said, when I read that, I was stunned, I was stupefied, I was shocked. Because how could they write something like that, and how could my government go along with something like that when President Clinton had just apologized for the Tuskegee experiment for 40 years? Black men went to the doctor thinking they were being treated, and they were being studied and never treated. MK Ultra, I have forged a relationship of great respect with the son of Paul Robeson. I don't know if y'all know who Paul Robeson is. Paul Robeson during the 1930s was, he was just, you know, a phenomenal voice, not just in theater and the arts, but he was also a political voice. And his son sued the United States government because Paul Robeson didn't die a natural death. Come to find out that the doctors that were treating him were MK Ultra doctors, MK Ultra mind control program of the United States government. Okay, next question. Yes.
Hello, Cynthia.
Hello.
My name's Sagar Shah. And first question I've got is, you reminded me earlier, you said something about the Carlyle Group.
Yes.
And when I'd gone to an IT exhibition a few years ago, then there's a UK agency which was there called Quinetic.
Yes.
And they are now, I think, 40% owned by Carlyle.
That's correct.
So the stuff, I mean, I'm just sort of hypothesizing here, but the stuff that happened in the US, if Quinetic is through all private equity stuff getting more owned by Carlyle, can the same thing not happen in the UK if Quinetic is being owned? Secondly, the question is, I'd read on the TV or the newspaper a few months ago, I think it was, what's his name, Obama? The...
Keith Olbermann?
Yeah, no, Obama, the...
Obama.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, Barack Obama.
Yeah, Barack Obama. He was saying that if he was to become president of the US, then he would take all the troops, all the US troops, that is, out of Iraq, and he'd go straight into Pakistan, because that's where a lot of the troubles root from. And this last question is regarding what are you going to be doing to, probably just like a lot of people are doing at the moment, to get hemp legalized in the US? What? To get hemp. Hemp.
Oh, hemp?
Yeah, sativa. Okay. So thanks very much.
Okay, with respect to Kinetic, of course, you know, when you're trying to do that thing I was telling you about, see the invisible and, you know, read the well, actually, this was actually reported in the BBC, and as someone who was trying at the time to track some of the stuff of the Carlyle Group, then I was pretty interested that your bioweapons lab could be taken over by a private entity. And it's my understanding that that happened without the knowledge and consent of the British people. So now, yeah, you got a darn lot to be afraid of, I would think, because you're amassing a whole lot. I mean, all of that, what do they call it, the institutional knowledge and the current research and capabilities of Kinetic are now in private hands. So you, the people, don't have control over that. To the extent that you have control over your own government, you don't have control over that. And it's the same situation in the United States as well. So you've got these people who believe that they can make a genotypically specific bioweapon. They believe in that. And then the government sets out to actually produce these weapons and, you know, so I don't, we all have to fear that. So the Kinetic, the other things, you know, about Barack Obama, you know, Barack Obama has to speak for himself. And I'm not so sure about the other matter that you mentioned, but I'm sure that the answer is contained within what you said.